I got the horse right here, the name is Paul Revere, and here's a guy that says if the weather is clear, can do, can do.
This is Bill Buncliffe. I want to welcome you back to another edition of the Can Do Horse Racing Podcast, where the heroes and history of horse racing come alive, part of the In the Money Media Network. Let's just say this up front. Writing is hard. Writing a book is hard. Writing a book while holding down your day job? Maybe the hardest of all. I met Dorothy Hours through good friend of this podcast, Jennifer Kelly. I suppose it's no surprise that Jennifer and Dorothy are well acquainted with each other. Published in 2007, Dorothy's Man of War, A Legend Like Lightning, covers, among many fascinating details about Man of War's career, the legendary match race between Man of War and the first Triple Crown winner, Sir Barton, which Jennifer chronicled from the Sir Barton perspective in her 2019, Sir Barton and the Making of the Triple Crown. Dorothy also authored 2017's Battleship, the story of a horse, an heiress, and a teenage jockey who combined to produce the first ever American winner of Great Britain's storied Grand National. As we speak, Dorothy is deep in the process of putting together material for her third book, one which she can't talk about until she gets the proposal confirmed, but our focus for this podcast was her becoming as a writer, as well as the process of writing itself. Maybe you collect or maybe you pay. Still gotta work that 8-hour day. Whether you like that job or not, better keep it on ice while you're lining up your long shot. Which is... As listeners know, I'm a big devotee of backstories, particularly so with authors. What made them fall in love with horses in the first place? How did they decide to become a writer? What's their process? What are the trials and tribulations of being a writer? I had a wonderful conversation on all those topics with Dorothy. I hope you enjoy too.
Well, I've always been a bookworm. And yeah, the love of horses has always been there. And Man of War, such a legend. So, you know, when I'm laying hands on all the horse books in the library, he is the most admired. And C.W. Anderson, who older listeners may know, certainly, you know, the horsey girls of my generation will know, he in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s did a whole bunch of beautifully illustrated horse books, his own lithographs. Man of War was his favorite. And so there's not just – he did do a book called Big Red that's all about Man of War.
Okay.
But he also, Man of War cropped up in various stories of his. So that's one way in which, as a kid, you know, even though Man of War was long gone by the time I was a kid, here was someone who had seen him in person raving about him and doing these majestic illustrations. And, so, folks, you know, if you want a taste, look up C.W. Anderson.
Okay.
If you haven't already.
We talked later in this interview about interesting side trips, anecdotes, details that add color to a story. You'll forgive me if I interject one of those here. Dorothy mentioned the books of C.W. Anderson. As she indicated, he was renowned not only as an author but as an illustrator, and books he published beginning in 1935 and continuing all the way through 1971. But even more interesting to me is that C.W. Anderson's legacy lives on in another way. A renowned youth theater located in Wilton, New Hampshire, Andy's Summer Playhouse, is not only named after C.W. Anderson, but boasts an alumni group that includes Emmy, Tony, Caldecott Medal, and Pulitzer Prize winners. Immortality can take many forms. I thought Dorothy might like that tidbit also, but let's get back to her story and hear how, while curiosity might have gotten the better of the cat, it helped launch Dorothy's writing career.
And when Secretariat came along, when I was a kid, people immediately, as soon as he did some of the spectacular things he did, they were comparing him with Citation, who was my dad's favorite racehorse from when he was a boy. And they were reaching back to Man of War. Wow, maybe this is the best horse we've seen since Man of War. So that's why as a teenager, some years later, my dad was teaching at West Virginia University, and we as faculty children had access to the library there. And it somehow came to my attention that, hey, you can go to the university library and look at microfilm. And I thought, ooh, I can see what they were saying in the New York Times the day after Man of War won this race or won that race. So that's where it started, long before it started turning into a book, was just this hunger as a fan to find out what people were saying in real time, you know, not what they were remembering 20 or 30 or more years later. And when I started finding some things that were different from the legends that got repeated over and over in books, that's where you sort of stick a pin in it, as people would say now.
Okay.
You know, and I went off and did other things, but always had the passion for horses and horse racing.
Things that were different from the legend. And I'm kind of, you know, you had a lot of great anecdotes in there, but I do want to ask you about, you know, some of the things that were different from the legend, because that's, you know, that's interesting.
Well, one of the first things I remember going to as a teenager in the West Virginia University Library was the Lawrence realization that Man of War famously won by an estimated 100 lengths. I mean, it was at least that much. You know, they just kind of rounded off to this gigantic margin. And the thing that surprised me the most, there are a couple of things, but I decided to go look at the day before the race. You know, just curiosity, New York Times, what, you know. And there is Hoodwink in the results. Well, he's running on Friday, and then he's in the results on that Saturday. Mm-hmm. So it's like, what? You know, the horse that he beat by 100 lengths ran the day before? What the heck? And you know, it makes you feel for poor Hoodwink. You know, he had done his best in this sprint, and then it's like the next afternoon, it's like, hey, what you doing? Oh, I'm racing? Who's that? Oh, Man of War? Oh, my Lord, you know? So it doesn't make any Man of War any less brilliant because he ran in world record time. And, you know, they agreed before the race. Another thing that surprised me was the conversations in the paddock before the race when they diverted a walkover by putting in Hoodwink. But then it's like, well, you know, we know who's going to win.
Right.
And it, you know, people are really anxious to see him go against time because he'd already been brilliant against time in the Withers and the Belmont Stakes and other occasions. So, you know, and Mrs. Riddle was one of the ones urging her husband, why not let him run all the way? And so they finally agreed that, well, at least let him loose down the stretch. So it's not like Man of War was hard pressed. He wasn't pressed by anybody, and his jockey wasn't hitting him or shaking him up or anything like that. He just let him go.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that he was allowed to stretch out however much he wanted at that stage, because some of the legends I had heard, and you know how things get repeated over time, and the next person who looks at the old source then paraphrases it in their own way, and things kind of migrate. So when I was reading Man of War things as a kid, often it would be like, and he was never out of breath, and we never saw the best he could do. And there's part of me that's going, wow, and another part that's kind of skeptical, because if you watch the Olympics, which we did, or, you know, other competitions, I mean, even the best athletes at some point, you know, they get out of breath, and it doesn't mean they're unfit or that they're not resoundingly the best. It's just, it's a physical reality. So I had that strain of skepticism in there, not that he wasn't a great horse, but like, well, what was really going on? And so even that small revelation that his team had agreed, you can let him loose down the stretch in this, because, you know, gives the crowd something to cheer for. You know, they don't want to see him pulled back. They just want to see him rolling along like he
let
can.
Let him roll.
He'll appreciate it. He's always eager to go. The Lawrence realization really was one of the keys to me deciding, wow, there's something here that hasn't really been explored.
One note Dorothy mentioned about her research brought back certain times and places for me. As modern tools increase their grasp, Those times and places fade into the dustbin of history, but nevertheless evoke strong memories.
So circle back around in the 90s, I got back to that thought of, hey, you know, what if I dug back into Man of War? And I used to think maybe that would be a book someday. Come to find out, you know, with more diving into microforms, because that's what was available in the 90s. You know, mm-hmm. the internet was just barely beginning as a public resource. So I went and stayed and worked at a friend's horse farm in New Jersey for a few months and went over to Princeton University's microforms room. You could buy a temporary library card access.
Okay.
And you're going through the New York Herald, the Washington Post, all these different 1919, 1920, and earlier and later newspapers.
Well, you're really bringing me back, you know, for the, you know, you've mentioned those of us of a certain generation, the process of going through microfilm or microfiche, you know, the...
Yeah.
Well, the stuff is very, always was very well indexed, right? The whole process of loading a cartridge or loading a spool and spinning through, stopping, and then magnify it so you can read it, right?
Oh, exactly. And then taking, you know, paying the library to make photocopies of parts you wanted to take home. And after 2 or 3 hours of that, you know, I'd start to get dizzy, and it's like, well, that's all for today, you know.
Well, the fumes from the printer, you know, that they use were to make you dizzy, right?
Oh, and it could go wrong in all sorts of mechanical ways. It's just like, ah.
Oh, God, I know.
It's no secret that I'm a lover of history, but history is so much more than a recantation of the past. Studying history not only informs the future, but, as you'll find in my conversation with Dorothy, can lead you down some unexpected, intriguing paths.
Kind of interesting. And obviously, you know a lot about the sport and done a lot of research on it. I almost feel like, and I hate to say this, uniquely in our sport, we've gone backwards. Horses don't run as frequently. The trainers certainly don't want them to carry as much weight. It's a feeling that I have. I'm curious what you think about that.
Being old enough to remember the 1970s racing when I was spending my allowance on Turf and Sport Digest, you know, when I was in fifth grade and onward, you know, that's enough decades to see the change. And because mile-and-a-half races at the top level on dirt were still common enough in the 70s that in the autumn you looked to some of those as championship-determining races. So it was a disappointment to me when the Breeders' Cup set the Classic at a mile and a quarter, because already you're losing something. You're losing a dimension. Mm-hmm. And when I think about horses like Secretariat and Seattle Slough and Affirmed, they all were proven at that mile and a half more than once. And I think, you know, people still remember Slough, especially as a spectacular stallion. Well, he had brilliance in his pedigree, and he also had 2 mile horses, not that far back.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had that potential to give you this blend like Man of War had. And it's like, why don't we see, not that you're going to see a horse like Man of War often at all, but why don't we see more horses who come close to that? I really feel like the sport not investing in endurance has something to do with it. Because, you know, we're just willfully breeding that out, saying, oh, a mile and a quarter is far enough, you know?
Yeah.
So that's sad to me. I feel like, yes, the modern young fans do see some tremendous horses. But to have an experience like I was fortunate to in the 70s when you've got those Triple Crown winners plus Spectacular Bid and Forgo, oh, my gosh.
Oh, right.
You know, I think he's one of the greatest rarely remembered horses. Because he was tremendous. He could sprint 7 furlongs even faster than Mr. Prospector, and he won the 2 mile when the Jockey Club Gold Cup was still 2 miles. Forgo won it.
Right.
So the horse who might be even faster than Mr. Prospector also won it 2 miles.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just, why don't we still care about that? You know, the only reasons I can think of are commercial breeding economics. But, you know, I wish the industry were incentivized in a way to say, hey, if we want to breed more Secretariats or Man-O-Wars or Seattle Sloughs, we need that stamina on dirt element, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you. It's it actually reminds me, anecdotally, one of the threads I wanted to kind of discuss with you was the jockey club, right? And to mm-hmm. me, in the modern day, this is a place where the jockey club could at least be taking a stance or at least advocating for, let's breed some of that back in. What's really interesting to me, though, in the book is the thoroughly arbitrary power that the jockey club had at that point in time to, like, judge, jury, and executioner, right? I mean,
right.
To anyone who's interested in jurisprudence, it's like, oh, my God.
Yeah, and they finally, it's been a while since I looked at this, but in the 1940s, they finally got challenged in court and lost. And that's a whole rabbit hole in itself. But so, yeah, I agree. I think we need more transparency than the jockey club had in Man of War's day. But at the same time, they could be, there were cases where they actually ruled people off the turf, as they put it, for flagrantly cheating in various ways. So, you know, in one way, it probably did keep the sport a bit cleaner than some of the moments when due process gets dragged out for years.
Yeah, well, there's that.
I don't claim to say there's any ideal approach. I'm truly glad that the people who are on the end of it, of having their licenses approved or not, have public ways to say, hey, wait a minute, here's my side. That's extremely important. It's just sometimes the delaying tactics in court, that's the other extreme swing of the pendulum, you know.
Right.
At the same time, it's really striking. If you go back to the primary sources, the microfilm or, you know, magazines, things from that era, it hits you how different. It's like, yes, it's familiar, it's the same, so many of the concepts are the same, and yet, oh my goodness, if we took a horse from 2024 and took him to the races in 1920, it's going to be a whole different experience for that horse. And, you know, starting with not having a starting gate.
Right.
So there are some really fundamental factors that if you want to understand Man of War, you need to be able to picture the racing world he's operating within, the conditions, you know, the environment.
Yep. Yeah. You mentioned, it's actually a really interesting anecdote, thread, and one that I think about a lot, even in today's sport, right? The barrier versus the starting gate. Now, it is interesting to read about how many times it takes to get a start correct in using the barrier method. But,
right.
You know, you watch any race today and how many horses hit the side of the gate coming out or leap, you know, when the gate opens. I seriously have wondered at times, honestly, if some racetrack shouldn't try, let me go back to the old walk-up start and see how that goes, you know. It would be interesting, I think, right?
It'd be very interesting. And, my mind's jumping ahead a little bit to the 1930s. Because in the late 30s, they did a survey of, you know, dozens and dozens of trainers and owners and so on about what starting method they preferred. And this was about 10 years after what they called the stall gate had been instituted. They still actually had, in a lot of places for a period of time, just open-ended stalls. And then it started to evolve into the doors that open.
Okay.
But the gate was still an evolving, fairly new technology.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they surveyed all these horse people, horsemen, I guess is the term, because surely they were all men at that stage, and Mary Hirsch and who else.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a strong current of support for the walk-up start.
Okay.
Instead of the gate. When you think to the match race with Seabiscuit and War Admiral, and Sam Riddle is painted as this extreme eccentric who wanted the walk-up start, at that period there actually was a sizable chunk of his community, the racing world, who said, yeah, that old walk-up start was better to me. So, you know, I'll try not to get off because, of course, obviously that didn't work out in Riddle's favor.
And there
were some other situations where I believe at Hialeah in the late 30s, they experimented with the Australian barrier, which was a webbing that went up in the air, with some two-year-old races, like just short two-year-old races. Mm-hmm. But you run into issues about this isn't the customer, this isn't what the starter is used to doing, for one.
Yeah.
And then also, even though the two-year-olds are new, supposedly they should be somewhat of a blank slate, it isn't what the jockeys are used to at that stage, many of them. You know, we have a new generation of riders by circa 1937-38. So I think that's a hurdle if you try to go back in time and say, well, let's, you know, maybe there are advantages to this old way. Well, it's going to be a new way to the people implementing
it. Good point.
I agree that some of the criticisms that were being voiced about the starts from the gate back in the 1930s could still be valid criticisms about the strain that they put on a horse's legs starting from a dead halt.
Flat-footed,
Whereas if they're walking, they're already in motion and they kind of spring more naturally into their gallop. And as you noted, sometimes they do bang into the gate. You know, they can actually get hurt by banging into the gate in certain ways. And so can the riders and the assistant starters.
The assistants too, right.
You've added hazards by having this big metal thing out there. But, you know, how do you really turn back the clock? I enjoy seeing the steeplechasers just casually stroll to the start. Yeah. and of course, their events are so much longer. It's not such a big deal
if the start's
a bit straggling.
Yeah.
But still, it's fun to see. It's like, look how calm they are. You know, they're just like, do-do-do-do-do. Okay, we turn around. Here we go. It doesn't have to be this big, clanging, noisy, you know.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier horsemen and all men, and talked about Samuel Riddle and how he was portrayed in the the Seabiscuit saga, but his wife was actually a very influential figure in Man of War's career also, which maybe that's one of the things that maybe attracted you or you kind of came to in the research, because, you know, to this point, I had never really read too much about her, but she was certainly influential in many ways in that horse's career.
She definitely was, and getting into the project, it was something I sort of discovered in just haphazard ways along the way, because, you know, he's always called Samuel D. Riddle's Man of War, you know, that, and you really do have to go deeper into it to see how without her, Sam Riddle never owns Man of War.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then her interest in how he was campaigned, too.
Right. She had a lot of influence over that, too. And like, you know, you really only hear about Mr. Riddle and not her, but she was certainly, like you said, he might not have even owned the horse if it wasn't for her.
Yeah, and, that's a whole chapter in itself. I won't spoil it for folks who might read it. But it made me think about how much she was a product of her times. And, you know, it wasn't the role. I mean, Mrs. Riddle was born in 1858. You know, when she was raised, you just didn't. You know, it was very rare for a woman. If a woman was seeking the spotlight, it was like, what's wrong with her? You know, it was pretty much the attitude.
The history one reads in a book like Man of War, a Battleship, which recounts the saga of the horse, the heiress, and the teenager who combined to take down the famed Grand National, will have you turning the pages, enthralled. But that, dear reader, trust me, does not come easy. Especially if, like Dorothy, you have your day job to do also. Patience and persistence, I thought, have to be in plentiful supply for a writer.
And I think that's a big reason why a lot of people who could, who actually might have a really interesting book in them, don't do it, because you just have to be persistent. You know, you have to be so stubborn about just continuing. And there are always going to be things you're like, oh, I want it to be good, but this isn't good, you know, and you have to keep working at it. And hopefully it keeps improving. For me, it's hard to say what the optimal could be, because with Man of War, for most of that time, I was doing a full-time job as well as researching the book and writing it. So the last year of Man of War, when I was working at the Racing Museum in Saratoga and got the contract and with St. Martin's, and it was like, okay, 1 year from the date of this contract, I have to turn in the manuscript. And it hit me, oh my gosh, we're almost into racing season here at Saratoga, and I can't do justice to these two things at the same time. So I was very fortunate, because a friend said, well, I need help at my farm if you'd like to come live here and do stalls. And that worked wonderfully well. Because, yeah, I had chores to do, but then there's a big chunks of the day that could be devoted to the book. And, I mean, that's a luxury that not everyone's can always make room for, you know? But, so, Man of War, from the time I signed, it's like there were several years of research and drafting that went into finally getting to the point of seeking an agent and then refining the book proposal and the chapters and so on to be ready to try to get a publishing deal. And then there was about 1 year of, okay, this is my job to finish this book. And then with Battleship, there was a period of time where I wasn't, after Man of War came out in 2006, there was a period of time where I was thinking about what might be next, but wasn't sure. It was just exploring and tugging different threads. So Battleship really started to get airborne in 2009, because the National Sporting Library in Middleburg, Virginia, has a fellowship program, and it was pretty new at that time. But I was lucky. I think I had tried for it in 2008, and my ideas weren't well-baked enough yet. But then I tried again in 2009 and got a fellowship to have basically the summer researching in their collection, which was very pertinent to Battleship, because they are very much in steeplechasing country, and a lot of their sources that they have in their library, they have some specialized sources there that if you want to learn about steeplechasing and steeplechasing in the 1930s, I can't think of a better place to
Where to go.
So with Battleship being published in the spring of 2013, and I would say May, June of 2009 was then when that really started to get into a serious gear. So you could say that was about 4 years of the intensive work. And again, for a good bit of that time, I was also doing office jobs. You know, I had a lot of periods during then of doing, like, long-term temp assignments and things. Before I had an advance from a publisher. Because that's a problem for writers, too. How do you stay afloat? You know, and for the vast majority are going to have to do, you know, paying gigs of some sort. You know, it, and then I gave myself the luxury of the last approximately year of Battleship, again, when there was a signed contract and an advance of saying, okay, now this is my job. But the lead up is a mixture. So, you know, how fast could it be if that's your only job ever?
Right.
It is another question.
I was fascinated to learn that Dorothy's research on Battleship was truly hands-on. As you'll hear, that hands-on approach definitely helped add authenticity to the story.
Even though being lifelong passionate about horses and loving any sort of horse activity I could lay eyes on, I had a lot more grounding in flat racing than in steeplechasing.
Okay.
And so it felt really daunting to try to understand Battleship's career the way people, you know, I'd done just a tiny bit of jumping on horseback. Nothing like cross country. You know, just lessons in a ring where you hop over some small things. But it was just enough when it got to the point where the teacher raised the bar to about 3.5 feet and you feel the horse gather in a different way.
Okay.
All of a sudden the horse gets serious, like, oh, okay. And instead of a little boop, it's like a whoosh. This arc where they push off. And so I just had the tiniest feeling of what it's like when you gather for a leap like that. And okay, now magnify that to where you're leaping over 5 feet, you know. But that was the extent of my feel for Battleship's world.
Okay.
All credit to the National Sporting Library for it immersing me in this to the extent where it's not like I'm an expert in that, but I felt like I was a translator, a medium.
Cool. Yeah.
That the information could come through, hopefully, in a... So, truly, when it was well-received in that world, you know, the people in Maryland and Virginia in particular, who still live a version of that, that is hugely meaningful to me.
It's interesting to contemplate how the research ends up dictating the flow of the narrative, as opposed to one's original conception dictating the course of the tale, sometimes doing so in unexpected ways.
Oh, that's exactly it for me. Because when I started feeling like, oh, here's another area where there's, oh, well, boy, this is a book. I never thought about this or that. I had very quick thoughts about, wow, how it could be framed and this and that. And then it's like, no, whoa. I don't want to promise something to a publisher that isn't what I'm actually going to deliver because it's just what you said. As you pursue it, you're going to discover things you never expected.
Yeah.
And if you have any, my mom's father was an historian and she always said he would follow the facts where they lead.
That's what it is.
I'm not doing this to impose some view on it. It really is to discover, you know, with Man of War in the first place, it was like that. You know, well, who was he if you met him at the barn? And with Battleship, it was sort of like, oh, my gosh, this horse doesn't have a legend, but he is one.
Yeah.
But I wasn't trying to inflate him. It was just let's understand what he did in all its the complexities that he worked through. So really for me, it's going to be – everyone's going to have their own version. But for me, I think – each of the books has been a mixture of curiosity and therapy because, you know, you don't want your own limitations to be making the clarity and the meaning and, you know, detracting from that. You want it to be as clear and meaningful as it can be.
Well, that's where the research is your friend, too, right? The more you've done, I think the – you know, your sensitivity to a particular community, it's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. But, you know, the more research that you've done, the more, you know, solid ground you're going to be on.
I mean, hopefully.
Yeah.
You know, it's research, it doesn't, how can I put this? It's like research doesn't guarantee that you're going to come to a solid, correct result because, you know, you could veer off into things that are not so reliable.
It can be a lonely existence, but you can hear the love in the old phrase labor of love when Dorothy talks about her passion for writing.
I often feel like the hermit who's up in the hills and you're sort of sequestered and then you go into town and you can't stop talking. I mean, mm-hmm. that's how it can feel like when you go from you're immersed in the writing to, oh, I can talk about the writing.
Yeah.
So it's fun to do. It's really fun.
Yes.
But
yeah.
it is rejuvenating in some ways for me mm-hmm. to be able to dive into these research puzzles. But yeah, if that were all you do, oh my gosh, that would be like solitary confinement. You know, that's not good.
Yeah, it's a labor of love, obviously. Whenever I say that, I always say it's love, but it's labor also, right? So, you know,
right.
It's important. Both words are meaningful in that phrase.
Well, they are.
I think I was most captured by Dorothy's points regarding the need to be true to oneself, particularly when that self is particular. It reminded me of the truth of the old Shakespearean adage.
And there are times when I read books that are really compelling, but how can I put it? My dad was a journalist. He taught journalism. He mm-hmm. became a professor of journalism, even though he loved history and had advanced degrees in that. But what I'm thinking is there's a certain really clean kind of writing mm-hmm. that gets your point across, that's very much like journalism. And sometimes there are very successful books that read like that. And it's very appropriate, and it connects with people. But I've kind of realized that my soul, if you will, mm-hmm. Really tends toward the lyrical. And, you know, my mom loved songs and poems. She was an English major. She had, and it felt sometimes like an infinite fund of song lyrics and poetic quotations and so on. So you get a feel for like the meter, the rhythms of language.
Yes.
And sometimes you choose a certain word because it makes your point, it fits, but it's got a flavor. And it makes the rhythm of the sentence a certain way. And so it's not like one style of writing is better, but I feel like I'm being a little bit rebellious by having a somewhat lyrical style. And it's not a style like something you impose. It's just who I am because
the
influences in me. But there are times when I wonder, would I be a more successful writer if I could get things out faster in just a real clean way? And time and again, I just come back to, well, that's not me, you know?
You gotta be you.
I can do little sprints of that, but ultimately that's a different kind of writer, that intrinsically, you know, that's a different consciousness, that's a different person. So I'm stuck, if you will, you know, more like with the fermenting through this, poetic soup, if you will. And it just is what it is.
Which is to say, keep your day job. Don't give it away. Keep your day job. Whatever they say.
I really enjoyed this conversation with Dorothy, and I hope it will give you some insight into the work that all of the authors I've interviewed on this podcast have done. Dorothy, Jennifer Kelly, Mary Perdue, Fred Cray. When you read their books, keep in mind that, as we said, it's both spawned out of love, but suffused throughout with labor. We'll be back again soon with another edition of the Can-Do Horse Racing Podcast. In the meantime, may good health and happiness and gratitude for both, for you and your loved ones, be yours today and always.
The horse. Ride!